Tonight on Arena, Elaine May, May Kay and Ruth Medjugorje together for a song called No Forever, and Barry and Liam Douglas on their new podcast, Wirelessin'. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Over the last 10 years, Elaine May, the Mayo-born electronica artist and producer, has released several EPs and featured on a hugely successful Irish Women in Harmony single called Dreams. But it took lockdown for Elaine to finally get around to creating her debut album. It'll be released later this year, but she's just given us the new single called No Forever, which features the former Fight Like Apes and Le Galaxy singer May Kay, with a video directed by music photographer Ruth Medjugorje. I'm delighted to be joined by Elaine, May Kay and Ruth right now. I have to start with you, Elaine. Why did it take a global pandemic to get you to sit down and do your debut album, do you think?
I think it wasn't really something that I kind of had been consciously thinking about, to be completely honest. I think when you are making the music that I make, it's very easy to kind of, you know, get into the summer festival season, play your shows and, you know, kind of focus on putting out EPs and kind of, you know, putting out singles and remixes and stuff. So I think for a long time, I kind of hadn't, you know, really thought about doing an album. And then last year, as you know, shows just stopped completely, and there was nothing, you know, in the way of live shows at all. So that gave me time to kind of think about what I had been working on and refocus. And I suppose I just kind of thought, right, this is a good time to kind of try and, you know, get the head down and get this done. So I'm still working on it at the moment. But yeah, as you mentioned, aiming for a release later this year. So.
There's a sense of, I suppose, nature abhorring a vacuum. Clearly, an artist abhors a vacuum as well. Does the empty space, I mean, the absence of live gigs obviously made a huge difference for you. Do you think that that really played into taking the time out to sit down and do this?
It definitely made me think that it was the time to do it, but it's been harder than... I definitely thought in like the first lockdown, I was like, wow, this is amazing. I have so much time now and I can like focus on, you know, writing new stuff and whatever. But like, it really was not that simple at all. And I think overall the process has taken, you know, longer. And I think that's okay too, because I think as this whole thing has gone on, people have realized that like it's a difficult time for everyone. It can be very hard to be creative, you know. So I've very much been kind of trying to take it at my own pace and do it kind of, you know, bit by bit, essentially, and yeah, focus on it that way.
What about for you, May Kay? How has the last year been? Has lockdown been positive or negative in terms of artistic production for you?
It has been a quite prolific time, I think. I had given myself no choice, really. I think we're constantly saying, all of us saying, if we only had time, we'd do all these things. We'd like get into things that we always use the excuse of not having enough time for. And yeah, then all of a sudden and under the most unimaginable circumstances, I was faced with nothing but time. And it's actually a really interesting way to work. I always thought that if I were given a choice, I would always want to be in a room with someone if I was collaborating with them. But there's something that's just, it's completely unjudgmental. Elaine gave me an instrumental track, and sometimes not being given a brief of any sort, like sometimes if you're collaborating with someone, they might give you reference tracks for what way they imagined it going. But we didn't do any of that. And it was actually really nice. It was just me on my own in a room writing it. And it's a really nice way to be, because you just do it and finish it and send it on.
I guess though there's a certain fear factor involved there, Elaine. If you just send the track as May described to us there, you send her off the instrumental track, and you leave it as a pretty open brief.
I think there can be, but to be honest, I think like, you know, the people that I work with, and I think anyone that's kind of, you know, has been in the industry for a while, like we're all kind of well able to be honest about how we feel about things. And I definitely think if I hadn't been happy, or we wanted to make some changes, or we wanted to continue working on it, which is so like is the norm, you know, really is the norm. That would have been totally fine. We just got really lucky with this one, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm afraid of that too.
Yeah, maybe explain, May. So you get this instrumental track, you respond and you're sending your response back with your fingers crossed, or thinking, oh, well, I hope we're at least in the same ballpark, even if we're not in exactly the same part of the field. Let's hope it's the same field. Is it a frightening prospect sending something back in that way?
I think, as Elaine says, this one's a bit of a rarity, to be honest. I knew I had something decent when I was writing it. But no, there is. That's I've turned off, like, delivered. You know when the two blue ticks come up on WhatsApp? I've turned that off because I can't handle if I've sent something to Elaine. I knew that she was there listening to it and wasn't getting back to me. So it is, if it's someone else's track and it's entirely, the instrumental is entirely Elaine's work. Of course, you do not want to have a conversation of like, well, look, it was just nice chatting. We might not use this, but at least we're in touch. That would have been brutal. So yeah, I'm very relieved.
Yeah, those WhatsApp things sometimes come back quite quickly.
Yes, sick of it.
Yeah, you kind of, it's better to have the two blue lines off, perhaps, or the blue ticks off. But clearly then, it was actually, you got back something very close to what you'd been thinking in terms of the vocals, did you?
To me that song feels like there's a kind of a mixed emotions in it. You know, I feel like, you know, it's kind of uplifting, but it's kind of sad as well. And so, you know, Mekay came back with these very emotive lyrics, and this really beautiful kind of sad story, which I think fits really well with the track, because, you know, it's not meant to be like a kind of a totally upbeat, clubby, dancey track. There's more to it than that, I think. And I think she kind of captured that for sure. So, yeah.
I think isolation and separateness were very much on your mind in the lyrics for this, May.
Yeah. It's been, while I say I've had a prolific year creatively, it's also been quite a lonely time too. And was a pretty bad time to be trying to make any relationship work. So I don't like giving this dude that much credit, so I'm not going to talk about it too much, but it was a very lonely time. And I think there's something, not to sound so cheesy, but it's the truth, there's a really explosive emotional kind of release in that music that Elaine wrote, and music obviously just, it can heal all wounds. So it felt like a very vulnerable, I felt very vulnerable. I think more than wanting Elaine to like the melody or whatever, I felt very vulnerable being so honest about something. So yeah, that's been a mad process.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that you were as upfront, because oftentimes singers and songwriters will kind of avoid saying, oh, it's related to my personal life, but you're being upfront and saying, no, it's very much, it came from that and the music released that within you. So Ruth Medjber, Mekay says to you, do you know what? I've been given this amazing piece of music, which has allowed me release something extraordinary that I wanted to get out there and deal with. And the link between myself and Elaine, who gave me the music, it's been absolutely perfect. There's been no problems. Now make a video and fit in and be perfect like the two of us are. What kind of pressure did that put on you?
No bother at all. I had been working with Elaine and Mekay separately for kind of the last 4 or 5 years. You know, I would have been a massive fan of Fight Like Apes and La Galaxy and Elaine's other work. So, and I'd done their photos. So actually it was Elaine that sent the track to me and said, will you take the press photos for this single that we're doing? And I listened to the track and I think I sent Elaine back about a 5 minute long voice memo that was like, oh my God, I love it. It's huge. It's amazing. And it was just a pure emotional gush of appreciation for this track. And I started to explain to her what I saw when I heard the song, which was very clear. You know, instantly I saw the visuals that it was black and white and it was soaring and it was huge and la la la. And she got back to me instantly and said, it sounds like this is a video, not a photo brief that you're telling me. And I was like, no, I don't do video. And she was like, will you try? So, so then I said, you know what, if there's going to be one track and one pair of amazing people that I'm going to do my first video for, it has to be these guys. So, yeah. And
like I tried to, I had a few moments of doubting myself. The old imposter syndrome kind of creeped in a bit, and I tried to back out of it on quite a couple of occasions. And both, all those times, Elaine kind of guided me back and pumped me up, going, "No, you got this. You're amazing." Yeah. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, sure, who cares?
So, but I guess similarly for you, Ruth, to what both Elaine and Maya have been speaking about, I mean, up until the pandemic, tour photographer for bands was predominantly what you were doing, very pressurised jobs, I would have thought. But Hozier being, I suppose, among the notable artists that you have photographed along the way. So had you got that big empty space to fill in as well?
Not as much. I during lockdown, I kind of did what most people did, which is self-employed people, music industry people, was I kind of had the same reaction, which was a fight or flight kind of like instinct to just try and get as much work as possible, even though there was nothing going. So I filled my days quite easily. But then there was a lack of connection with the work I was doing. I wasn't really collaborating with anyone. It wasn't as artistic or as creative an output as I really needed, and that's what I was missing. And I, you know, I was doing these window portraits, which was so random and so far removed from my tour life. And you know, I'd gone from photographing Glastonbury to photographing people's windows.
Hang on a wee second there, because you have to explain what that photographing people at the windows was. Your book, the book that you did and that is currently out, Twilight Together, amazing idea for the situation we found ourselves in the last 12 months, effectively. Explain what it was.
I'll give you the short version of it. So last March, you know, like everyone else, like Elaine was saying, live music had stopped, and I was kind of, my career that I had essentially thrown my life into was put on pause. And then I'd lost about 2 years worth of work in about 2 weeks. So I had this idea one evening while I was sitting in my apartment looking at all the other apartments across from me. At twilight, they all start turning on their lights. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be lovely to capture this? Because everybody in Ireland is at home right now. So I came up with the idea of photographing people through their window frame, looking into their house at twilight. So it's lovely kind of blue light, and inside is all golden and gorgeous and warm and welcoming. And I travelled around Ireland for 3.5 months photographing people at home during lockdown. And then thankfully it became a book that was released in November and a little exhibition. And it really was my crutch or my lifeline that got me through the pandemic, you know, emotionally more than anything else. And it kept me going. But it was pretty much overnight. I had gone from being Ruth Medjber, the music photographer, to Ruth Medjber, the windows photographer.
And Ruth Medjber, the video maker as well, which you now are, given that you've given it to us for no forever. So Elaine, coming to you then on the story that's told in the video, how closely does that link into the story that May Kay has already described to us about this, you know, the idea of the not being able to get a relationship to work in these times?
I think you should take that one, May Kay. Probably.
She's the one to answer. How closely does it stick to the story you told me, May Kay?
Yeah, well, it's really amazing. I think we take for granted, well, I certainly did take for granted that photography and video making are closely linked because they're a similar medium, obviously, but it's a completely different. And I just don't trust Ruth when she says she's not sure about something. I still don't. She tries it sometimes, but I'm like, I'd say you're more sure than most people would be. She approaches things in a really interesting way. But yeah, the video is, it's very like, you know, I'm on my own in these vast landscapes in most of the scenes. Which is exactly as I felt about a situation that I was in. So she absolutely hit the nail on the head with it in terms of what I imagined.
I think it was quite strange, actually, because I never asked you for an interpretation of the lyrics. I just listened to the song and kind of made up my own interpretation and said, right, this is what the video is about based on the lyrics. And it was only when we were filming, I kind of went to you. I was like, did I get this right? Is this what this is
about? You said that about 10 times.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Like, I'm so sorry if I have taken your lyrics totally wrong here, but we're basing a whole music video around it now.
Oh, no, it was it's perfect. It's really, and it's still, I don't think it's grim at all. You know what I mean? I still, on paper, it sounds like we're describing something quite like really sad, but actually there's a real strong vulnerability through the whole thing that I think is most people can really connect with.
And Ruth, you worked with an all-female crew. What did that bring to the project, do you think?
Do you know, because it was such a skeleton crew because of COVID restrictions, that the majority of the time it was just myself, Maykay, and Elaine out there. And when, you know, when Elaine was on camera, Maykay was assisting me, and then we'd swap around. And then just one of the days we needed just a couple of extra pairs of hands, and we said it to our friends, and up turns Sinead White and Alva Reddy, two incredible musicians in their own right. And before we just looked around, it was like, we have an all-female crew here. And for me personally, as first-time director who was already nervous enough, it made it such a relaxing atmosphere for us all. And we were just having a dance, having a bop, you know, just really, really enjoying it. And I just felt so comfortable. I mean, I think 90% of the time when I work in the music industry, I turn up on the job and I might be the only woman there. So it was just very refreshing, but it was totally accidental, which was lovely. Okay.
Well, listen, thanks to the three of you for speaking to us this evening, because we are going to finish up by listening to the track. It kind of makes sense at this point. Unfortunately, we can't play the video on the radio, but that's presumably, is it up there on YouTube already, or will it be up fairly quickly?
It's up there now since Friday.
I saw a copy of it today, but I wasn't sure whether I saw it on YouTube or whether I was just given a link to it. So you can get it on YouTube if you go looking for it. Thanks to Elaine May, Maykay, and Ruth Medjber. The track that we've been speaking about is Know Forever. Elaine May's debut album out later this year, she promises. We're going to hold you to that. And Twilight Together, the book that Ruth Medjber was telling us about, is published by Doubleday. So let's finish up then by listening to Know Forever. No Forever from Elaine May and Maykay. And the video that we were speaking about from Ruth Medjber is now available. There's a link to it on our own Twitter page, which is at RTE Arena. Lots of translation of it there at the end for you, just in case you need it. Now or Never, the title of the song in English, Maintenant ou Jamais in French. And it's from a band called either Catastrophe or, I'm guessing, Catastrophe, since they are a French band. And that is a single or a tune that has been heard on season 4 of Call My Agent. Now, later this evening on the programme, we plan to speak with Barry and Liam Douglas. Barry Douglas, of course, concert pianist, world-renowned concert pianist, and also the artistic director and conductor, or director of Camerata Ireland, the All-Ireland Orchestra. Liam, his son, a guitarist, and working with a band of his own. And the two of them in this podcast series, which is called Wireless, and are talking to each other about their various experiences, obviously from very different ends, or at very different points in their career. But at one point, Liam, the son, asks Barry, the father, about, you know, do you have any rituals when you're going on stage? Things you do, or little things that you feel if you don't do that, it'll all go terribly wrong. So in response to that particular question, this is the story that Barry Douglas told.
I read this book, Melvin Bragg wrote about Richard Burton, and Richard Burton told him a story about Laurence Olivier in the National Theatre in London. And it was the one with the proscenium arch and the curtains. Anyway, before the audience would be in, the curtains were closed, and before he went out on stage, before the whole play started, he would go to the edge of the stage, behind the curtain, and he would swear at the audience. You know, he didn't hate
not
the audience.
Not out loud.
No.
Just mouthing it. Just
they wouldn't have heard because they're talking and everything.
Yeah.
And it was his way of kind of girding his loins and making sure, and, you know, getting into gear.
Yeah.
So he had that kind of aggression, this pent up energy about to burst and explode. And then he said, okay, curtains. And then he would come out and be magnificent. So I took my lead from him. So I swear a lot as I walk on. I have to be careful in case the person who has said, "Okay, Mr. Douglas, away you go," you know, in case they hear me. Mm. But there's a lot of F words and other words. And then I feel good.
A lot of F words and other words. And then I feel good, says Barry Douglas, one of Ireland's greatest ever classical pianists, former gold medal winner at the Tchaikovsky International Piano Competition in Moscow, and for some years now artistic director of the All-Ireland Chamber Orchestra Camerata Ireland. Liam, as I said, also a musician, but has chosen a markedly different path as a rock guitarist, in which guise he's co-founder of a group called Becky and the Keys, whose debut single Cold Water Creek was released in 2019. And Barry and Liam recently launched their own podcast. You just heard a sample from it there about the ups and downs of being musicians, the disasters, the triumphs, the anxieties. And both of them, I'm happy to say, are joining me this evening on the line. Little did I think, Barry Douglas, that you'd be swearing in the wings before you went on to play such wonderfully elevating music.
Oh my goodness, hello Sean. I hope you didn't hear me swear before I came on the radio tonight.
Oh, did you not know the microphone was open?
I wonder what these little green things going up and down. Oh, that's my voice, right? Yeah. No, it's you know, everybody has a different way of coping with stress or anxiety. It's not so much anxiety when you perform, but you have, you know, butterflies in your tummy. And so you have to focus on the music. And sometimes you want to kind of exclude everything else and just really focus on walking out there and sitting down and getting straight into the music, because that's what you want to do to, you know, for the audience. And whatever tools of the trade you use, it doesn't really matter. They don't all have to hear about it, of course. Of course, I didn't say that myself.
I was going to say, don't be doing a podcast telling them all about it. Then. The idea for this podcast, where did it come from, Liam? Did Barry say to you, let's sit down and have a chat with each other and record it? Or was it, in fact, were you the instigator here?
Well, hi, Sean. Lovely to speak with you again. We talked about doing it for a long time, and Dad said he was wanting to do something in terms of, you know, blogging or getting his stories out there as a musician, because he had more time, obviously. And I said, you know, the perfect thing to do would be to do a podcast, because they're more accessible, and, you know, everybody's listening to podcasts these days. So I thought, you know, you should do a podcast. And then me talking with my dad about what to talk about, you know, different stories, you know, from traveling to concerts and things. Mum said, you should record these conversations. And that's how it really started. It was just Mum saying that, you know, you two talking and bickering on what to talk about should be the podcast.
What? So in fact, you were talking about the project, and it was, my mother always knows best, doesn't she? And your mother said, there's your podcast there, don't go looking any further. Would you be wary about that sort of thing, Barry? I mean, as a classical musician, or as any kind of a musician really, certainly as a pianist who doesn't sing, that I'm aware of at any rate, maybe I'll get that in another episode of Wireless. And as a classical musician, it's the music that does the talking. Were you wary about putting yourself out on the microphone like that?
You know, if it had been 10 years ago, maybe I would have said to Liam, look, let's leave it for 10 years and I'll do it. But I don't know. I think it's fascinating. Well, maybe I'm talking myself up too much here, but I think it's interesting for people to hear. We musicians, and certainly classical musicians, seem so aloof and serious, and we are sometimes aloof and serious, so it's too much so. You know, it's just a way of humanizing that we are people that, you know, we do a day's work, and sometimes it's a struggle, sometimes we're tired, and sometimes we're unsuccessful. And I think, you know, just trying to make it seem more accessible for people, that it's not just a guy up there with black tails and a white shirt and playing a big black and white piano. You know, it's something, it's a human process. You know, it's music is a language, as you say, and we're letting the music talk, but getting there is, you know, it's quite a palaver.
Yeah, and you bring us right back, in fact, to your early days as a musician. And it's so often the case in these scenarios, it was a teacher, wasn't it? Or something that happened at school, in fact, that was hugely formative in terms of you deciding that you wanted to be a pianist.
Yeah, it was my very first day in Botanic Primary School in Belfast. And
so what age were you at that stage?
So I was just barely four. Hmm. And then they had this little concert in the gym hall, and it was a pianist and a couple of violinists. And I just knew that's what I'm going to do. I don't know why. It's some kind of message came to me from afar. And I couldn't work out what this bow was. It looked like a kind of sword. So I said, that's really strange. but the thing was that it was the piano I was immediately interested in. And my parents talked to some neighbours and they said, well, we're about to get rid of this piano. Why don't you just take it? And so that's what I had. That was my first piano.
But was it, can you, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight now, can you see something or work out what that something was about the piano that attracted your four-year-old imagination?
I mean, the piano is really, I mean, you don't need anybody else. You've got all the equipment at your fingertips. I mean, it can be an orchestra, it can be a choir, it can be, it can do anything you want. It can be an oboe player, it can be a guitar player, you know, just depending on what you play. And I love that versatility and that all-encompassing ability the piano has to make colours and to spin a yarn. And I think that probably was what I liked, is that, you know, I could do everything if, you know, I would just let the piano speak.
Well, do you know what? Why don't I let the piano do a little bit of speaking now? I have a recording of you here playing from something that's very suitable for today, one might think, given that it's February, from Tchaikovsky's The Seasons. But this sounds a little bit different to the February we're currently experiencing. Yeah, there's a fair few colours coming in there for sure. That's a little section from The Seasons from Tchaikovsky, that being February. Barry Douglas playing, and Barry Douglas and Liam Douglas, Barry's son, on the line with us this evening talking about their new podcast, Wireless. And given what your father has just told me about his immediate reaction when he saw the piano as a four-year-old, Liam, I wonder what it was like having a concert pianist in the house with you all the time, probably rehearsing portions of the day when all you could hear was piano coming from some other room in the house. Was there a four-year-old in you that said, well, the one thing I'm not doing is that particular instrument?
That's exactly how it was. I mean, we used to, me and my siblings, our bedroom was above the room where our dad practiced. And we'd be woken up to our dad practicing, and it was the most annoying thing in the world to hear that piano. And then going to concerts, you know, it was fun to see, you know, dad, you know, performing in front of hundreds of people, but it's just, everyone would say, you know, what is it like? And it's just, he's just our dad. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's why mainly the one reason why I wanted to do the podcast is to show that he's a normal guy. He's funny. And, you know, it's not just like my dad said, you know, it's not just someone getting up on stage and doing, you know, a major classical piece. It's more just, there's so much more to it that no one ever sees, especially in classical, you know, musicians, you know, it's, well, there's so much missing that you don't see.
Well, you both talk about various heroes, and one of your heroes, Liam, is Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And you met him in Paris. You were living in Paris, I think, at the time, were you?
No, we had moved back to Northern Ireland, and then we were over there for the holidays, the summer holidays, and we were just walking around, and I saw this man, and I just thought, that looks an awful like Jimmy Page. And that whole holiday, I was listening to Led Zeppelin and just dissecting exactly what he did, you know, in songs like A Whole Lot of Love and Good Times, Bad Times, and just the scene there, the man himself. And I remember saying to my sister, just, the guy who wrote Stairway to Heaven, you know?
Yeah.
Just being able to say that, it was just such a surreal moment, and I hope to meet him again.
Yeah, and you had a chat with him, I know, and that he was quite kind to you in terms of the time that he gave you. But similarly...
He was lovely, yeah, yeah.
Similarly, Barry, you had a big hero in Sviatoslav Richter, the pianist.
That's right. It was through my teacher at Royal College of Music, who was absolutely one of his, probably his best fan in the world, and introduced me to all this great music. And we went to his concerts all over, mostly in France, but also in London. He didn't play often in London. And then I got to meet him several times. And then he was getting a fellowship at the Royal College of Music. And so, because I had got a fellowship in the past, so we all had dinner together. And it was one of the most exciting times to sit down. You know, when you have dinner with somebody, it's really much different to, you know, actually meeting them in a formal setting or a lineup for asking for an autograph or something like that. And so, fascinating guy, a philosopher, so intelligent. His mind was always dissecting things, explaining things. And what he did at the piano, he really made the piano sound like an orchestra. And he was absolutely incredible. And yet he was so, so modest. I learned so much about how a human being can have such incredible, exceptional ability, but at the same time be just a regular human being.
Well, which is funny, but exactly what Liam was talking about in terms of the podcast itself. So episode one is out there and available to us right now. Have you put any of the others down, Liam, or as in have you recorded them yet? Or are you still bickering about what you're going to bicker about in the next episode?
We have two episodes out already. And next Monday, it'll be the third episode. And then we'll probably be recording the fourth one. And then the week after will be the fifth one. Because I'm home in Northern Ireland now with mum and dad. So we'll
time
get
to do that.
The next two out of
the way. Finish up with a little bit of your own music, Liam, just in the interests of balance. So Loved and Lost, give me a little line into this before we finish up.
It's an early demo and Becky and I have been working on it, you know, for the band and just... Enjoy.
Oh, well, we will indeed. That's Liam Douglas and Barry Douglas. A little bit of Liam here, and I'll give you details about the podcast afterwards.
'Cause I can see how it used to be. Smiles, friendship, laughter, then love and heartbreak after. Is it in my
the title of the track, Loved and Lost, from Liam Douglas. In fact, from Liam Douglas and his band, Becky and the Keys. And The Wirelessen, which is the new podcast from Barry and Liam Douglas, is available now on iTunes, Apples, and of course, all other podcast platforms. Twelve and a half minutes to eight on Monday night's Arena. Hafsa Zayan has just published her debut novel, We Are All Birds of Uganda. It explores race, religion and cultural belonging from two very different perspectives. But writing isn't the only string to her bow. Hafsa also works as a dispute resolution lawyer in London. And she's the winner of the inaugural Mercury Books New Writers Prize, a prize which was set up by none other than the musician Stormzy. And delighted to have Hafsa Zayan join us on the line now. I say it's your debut novel, Hafsa, but were it not for this competition, it might be nothing than an idea that was flying around your head as you were working as a dispute resolution lawyer.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fairly accurate summary of how things might have been. The prize was a wonderful little window of opportunity that allowed me to kind of write down an idea that I'd had in my head for a while. But I'd never really had the time or the motivation to commit to writing. It was definitely spurred on by Stormzy's initiative, and I'm not sure it would have existed without it.
So, what did you have to submit then, if you had nothing more than an idea?
So, to enter the competition, you only needed to submit 2,500 words, which is about four pages of A4. It didn't take too long to write that up, and then after that, you just had to wait to see if they would select you. And I was selected. At that point, they asked for the full manuscript. I didn't have one. I had nothing except the 2,500 words. But they'd given us 7 days to give them the manuscript.
So
hurriedly wrote. Yeah. I just hurriedly wrote the whole thing in 7 days. I hurriedly wrote as much as I could in 7 days, which wasn't a full manuscript. It was about, I think, 4 chapters. Mm. And I submitted that thinking I'm obviously not going to win because everybody else who's been shortlisted, there was about 20 of us, probably already has a full manuscript. But then much to my surprise, I ended up winning.
Right. So whatever happened in that shortlisting process and getting down to that, what you submitted was enough. But then you did have to finish the novel, because obviously I wouldn't have it sitting in front of me here had you not gone and finished it. So I said that we're looking at the ideas around race, religion, cultural belonging, two very different perspectives. Two men, in fact, a grandson and a grandfather and grandson, telling us their experience of life. If you tell me a little bit about the son, or the grandson rather, who is the present day character, if you like, Samir.
Yeah, sure. So Samir is a second generation Ugandan Asian immigrant. So his parents were born in Uganda and then promptly chucked out after Idi Amin's decree in 72. And they came to this country essentially as refugees. Samir was born and raised in the UK. He's never been to Uganda. He's never been to India, where he's sort of ethnically from. And he works as a lawyer in central London, in the city. And he pretty much has everything that you could possibly need or want. He's financially secure, he has friends, he has lots of booty calls, he's living the life, so to speak. But there's an incident in the book which you know, sort of calls him back to his home, where his family live in Leicester, and that triggers an entire process of rethinking his life in general, and particularly wanting to find out a little bit more about where he came from, his ancestry, his history, his heritage, and then the book sort of follows his developmental journey thereafter.
And in the meantime, I suppose, in alternative chapters or alternate chapters, we then get the story of the grandfather, who obviously is two generations back and who was in Uganda at the time of the independence and the Asian population being asked kindly to leave. Maybe if we, he's writing letters all the time. Tell us about the first letter we get from him, which I must say is quite heartbreaking in many ways. And it's back in 1945, he's writing that first letter.
Yeah, so he's writing this letter at the end of the Second World War. And he's just suffered the loss of his wife, who he calls sort of the love of his life. And he's been asked by, you know, some members of his extended family to marry somebody else now that he's effectively, you know, single, a widower. He basically is asked to marry one of his cousins. And so he does that out of familial duty. And this letter that he's writing on the very first sort of chapter that's written from this perspective, from Hassan's perspective, he's writing on the night of his second wedding.
Yeah.
So he's not massively happy about the situation.
Yeah, and there is something heartbreaking. I mean, he clearly was very much in love with his first wife, and he's going on his own journey in regarding that particular relationship. But I guess the question here is the presumption when we hear, of course, that your young character is a lawyer, albeit that he's male. The presumption is, all right, well, this is clearly the dispute resolution lawyer who's writing the book is in there somewhere, and that this is her grandfather that we're, or some two generations back from her family that we're looking at. But it's not your family that it's the centre that was certainly, I don't think, was the starting point for this idea.
No, not at all. So in many, many ways, the book is deeply personal to me, and all of the themes that it covers I'm deeply sort of familiar with, and they're very close to my heart. I am half South Asian, half African myself. That's my sort of ethnic mix. But I'm not Ugandan South Asian. So I'm not from East Africa or Indian, which is where, from Gujarat, which is where the majority of the Indians that came over to East Africa were from. I'm Pakistani and West African. So a lot of the themes that are covered in the book are deeply personal to me. But the actual genesis of the story came from my in-laws, because my husband, when I met him about 6-7 years ago, introduced me to this story. I had never heard of the Ugandan Asian expulsion, and his family are South Asian Ugandan expellees. This is when I first learned of the story. And I was just very, very shocked that I'd never heard it before. I spoke to some of my friends who'd never heard it before, and I just thought, well, we need to tell this story, because people of my generation just completely seem to pass them by.
And I'm guessing there are a lot of people listening this evening who are saying, I don't particularly know that story either. So I guess you describe at one point in the book, one of the characters talks about this idea that, I suppose, in some ways, the South Asian community in Uganda, they were kind of a buffer between the British colonialists and the native Ugandans in the country. They were in that in-between position. What happened then? How were they treated when independence came?
Yeah, so Uganda was actually a protectorate rather than a full-blown colony. And the British had, which essentially meant that the Ugandan locals had some degree of autonomy over their governance, but it was very, you could effectively call it a colony. There were sort of different tribes or different parts of the Ugandan population who were given more control. So that obviously in and of itself created some division between the Ugandans locally. What they did with the South Asians is they had them come over from India, and some of them were indentured laborers. So some of them came to build the railway. Others came really just for the purposes of trade. So you had a different sort of variety of South Asians coming over to East Africa. And this happened sort of at the end of the 1800s, the early 20th century. So they'd been there by the time of the expulsion, which was in 72, for quite some generations, two or three generations, possibly, some of them. And the British were essentially putting the Asians, like you said, like a buffer between the local population who were, entitled to basically farm the land and then not allowed to trade. And then the Asians who were there left and they were allowed to trade. And they traded with the British, and they did, did a lot of exports internationally as well. And the Africans, the local Africans, they didn't have that opportunity because of the rules that had been imposed by the British. So on independence, effectively, you were left with the British sort of departing and leaving this rather messy scenario, behind, which is characteristic of the way that they left many of their ex-colonies when they left.
And effectively, the South Asians who didn't have a Ugandan passport were told to leave, and they were given very short notice to do so. Obviously, you're looking at a very big story here in terms of national independence, but also particularly through the character of Samir, the younger, the grandson in the situation here, you're looking at the whole idea of personal independence and maybe personal independence from the family. Do you see that, the individual within the family pretty much like the group within the nation? Is that one of the points you're making?
It's absolutely one of the points. I mean, the story for Samir particularly is a journey, exactly like you say, of development and personal independence set within the wider context of the Hassan story, which is also in its own way a journey of developing some form of independence. There are characters in the Hassan chapters which go through their own independent development, like Shubnam, his second wife. By the end of the novel, she's sort of, absorbed and become an independent individual, even in Hassan's eyes. But yeah, it's there's definitely a parallelism there. But I think with Samir in particular, it comes back to the fact that he's trying to be independent and leave his sort of familial duties and sort of in a way run away. He's running away to Uganda. He runs away wherever he can. But, the irony of it is that he, in finding his, in coming back to his own heritage and his own culture and his own history, that's how he finds peace, or that's how he comes to find peace. So there's a message there about how you sort of try to get away from who you are and not really being able to do that without really coming to terms with who you are.
And another very important debate within it, which I can't get into now, is this whole idea of multiculturalism versus integration. And that's a very interesting debate within it. Now that you've managed to get novel number one done in probably a little bit more than 7 days, I'll grant you that, is novel number two, is it jumping off the press as we speak?
It's not. I feel I wrote novel number one in 6 months. And I felt sort of a bit wary after that of writing anything again for many years. But the problem is that once you've written one, your mind starts to, you know, I've got quite a few ideas up my sleeve. Nothing's been committed to type yet.
Well, right. Well, you clearly need a competition to put the skates underneath you. But lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for that. That's Hafsa Zayan talking to us about her debut novel, the winner of the Mercury Prize, as we said, published by Mercury Books, an imprint of Penguin. And the novel is called We Are All Birds of Uganda. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.